Hi, and welcome to Climate Tracker Weekly, where we hear stories that matter to young climate journalists around the world. I'm your host, Chris Wright. In this episode, we talk to Julie Bordin, a French and South African multimedia journalist whose work has focused on migration and human rights, even from the challenging shores of Lesbos in Greece. Julie shared her experience as an activist and a journalist, and we chatted a lot about that challenging line between journalism, activism, and maintaining some sense of objectivity. It's a really interesting chat, and I hope you enjoy it. Here is our interview. Hi, Julie. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. It's a little bit early for you this morning, right?
Yeah. Well, it's only 8 a.m., but it's a bit early for me.
Well, fair enough. Thank you so much for joining us. Julie, as we often do on this podcast, I'd love to know, what is your story?
Well, I tend to describe myself as a French and South African multimedia journalist. I grew up moving around with my parents. We were moving countries every 4 years. And so I lived in several countries. And I was always a very curious kid. I was always listening in on my parents' conversations, which was very, very annoying for them at times. And at some point, I realized that I could maybe make it into a positive side. And I got interested in journalism through that. And I studied in Paris for my bachelor's, and I did a master's in journalism and in international relations. I couldn't choose between video and written journalism. So I'm kind of doing both. And after my studies, after in 2019, I went to the island of Lesbos in Greece, and I started getting involved more on the activism side, kind of reporting for an NGO on what was happening with the refugees arriving on the island. It's one of the hotspots in which a lot of refugees are arriving and being kept in camps on the island. Mm. And since then, I've been quite involved in this kind of activism, migration activism in Europe with different NGOs.
That sounds quite incredible. And I'd love to dive into that. Obviously, a lot of the story about migration does have broad links to climate change, but it also has much more direct links to kind of how governments deal with people moving around. How do you think the situation in Greece reflects how the European Union is dealing with migration?
I think it very clearly reflects the completely inhumane policies that the European Union has put in place. Of course, I'm saying this as an activist, but I think even as a journalist, I could say that without being biased in any way, because it's very obvious. There's thousands of people living in the most flimsy tents you could imagine, with almost half of them being children, most of the children being under 12, lots of babies, and all of them living in these conditions, and also lots of people being illegally pushed back towards Turkey. I also worked in the Mediterranean Sea with an NGO that has a monitoring airplane that flies over the Mediterranean Sea, and it witnesses often the border guards of Europe, Frontex, collaborating with the Libyan Coast Guard to bring people back to Libya, which is a country in which they're being tortured and raped and sold into slavery. So I think it shows very clearly this climate of such a fear of migration that we're completely building up our borders as a trying to make them as unpassable as possible.
And if we assume that there's a complex series of reasons why people migrate, with kind of poverty probably underlying a lot of that, and the kind of difference of opportunities underlying a lot of that. But if we assume that the impacts of climate change will most likely just add to the incentives that people have for leaving, particularly parts of Northern Africa and trying to make it to the European Union, what do you think that future looks like?
I think it looks quite grim, to be honest. Actually, I saw yesterday that Frontex, the border police of Europe, has actually just had one of their first conferences on climate, which is quite symbolic, I think. Mm. And yeah, if we imagine that climate change will, in a certain way, increase migration flows across the world and also towards Europe and towards the West in general, I think we can probably expect an increase in securitization at our borders and an increase of in human rights violations too.
By securitization, you mean making it harder for people to kind of cross borders, right?
I mean, first there's a policy of deterrence. So trying to make it as horrible as possible to make them not want to cross, which has been very clearly shown that it doesn't work, but still somehow it seems like Europe still hopes that having people die at the border, live in horrible conditions for years with just in the most horrible conditions stops people from migrating, even though it clearly doesn't. And also the increase in securitization in the sense of increasing the border police. So Frontex is supposed to get a huge increase in their budget and in their forces. And just, yeah, building these higher walls with more and more technology and more police forces at the border.
And as a European and kind of as someone who, you know, knows a lot of other Europeans, what do you think the sentiment is across the people that you know, at least, in terms of this balancing act between obviously showing compassion and allowing people to come into Europe and trying to create some sort of sense of an immigration policy where people are meant to follow certain rules?
Well, Europe has signed international treaties on, for example, refugee rights, which it's not respecting currently, at least in my opinion. I mean, also very clearly because they're practicing pushbacks, which is opposed to the non-refoulement principle that you can't push people back to a country where they're in danger without processing their asylum claim first. Of course, the people who saw me tend to be activists. So, and a lot of activists for open borders that are saying that everyone has a right to have a dignified future and a right to choose their life to a certain extent. And so not only refugees and people in acute danger should be allowed to choose and to try to find a safe place to live, but also people fleeing poverty and people fleeing a life that is just impossible for them to live.
And do you think if the number of migrants potentially increases over the next few years, do you think that there will be a moment where Europeans change the way that they approach migrants? Maybe or maybe not, this has something to do with climate change, but I can only imagine that the number of migrants is most likely going to increase. And if that's the case, do you think that there'll ever be a moment where Europeans as citizens and as policymakers basically get together and say, maybe we can approach this differently?
In a positive sense, I would love to hope so, but I have quite little hope on it. I think in the trajectory that we've seen it evolve in the past 5 years since 2015, there was quite a big increase in migration in Europe. It's just been going in a sense of closing our borders, closing up these walls and building what some people call a fortress Europe. And lots of people have already theorized the idea that there will be a green fortress Europe in the future. Europe where we will not be as impacted by climate change. And so life will still be more livable here. And we will only be building our walls higher and becoming more against people coming here, and people that are maybe suffering from worse living conditions because of the climate. And we've already seen it, for example, it's not directly the climate, but the Canary Islands have seen a big influx in people coming from Senegal. And lots of these people are fishermen who have to leave Senegal because there are no fish anymore. And they cannot survive anymore. Of course, this is not directly linked to climate. It's linked to overfishing, but it's also environmental issues that are, in this case, pushing people to cross the Atlantic or part of the Atlantic on small boats towards the Canary Islands.
Sure. And it sounds like a trend that, you know, increasing climate variations, increasing ocean acidification, you know, it's not going to help. It doesn't sound like these are situations that, as you say, you know, maybe have a series of complex reasons why they exist now, but that complexity is only going to get probably a little bit worse thanks to to, you know, changes in rainfall, changes in drought, changes in ocean temperatures. I did want to kind of pick up on one thing you said before, because you stopped yourself at one point and you said, as a journalist, I would say this, but as an activist, I would say this other thing. And I just wanted to kind of dive into that and kind of learn a little bit more about your journalistic journey. Why do you feel that you speak differently as a journalist or an activist?
It's quite hard for me to answer that because I haven't actually reported much as a journalist on migration issues directly. I've been there as a photographer and I've worked for NGOs. And I think it's an issue which totally questions the idea of journalistic objectivity. This idea that you have to show both sides all the time. For me, I've lived on Lesbos. I lived there for about 5 or 6 months, and it was very clear that you cannot show both sides because there's one side that is so much clearer and stronger in terms of the importance that it needs to be heard and needs to be talked of than the other side, which would be the side of the governments. But I do struggle with this idea that I think when I was in journalism school, it was something that was taught to us that you have to show both sides of the story. Almost that both sides are equal. And it is an idea that is really kind of pushed onto journalists and especially young journalists that you have to be absolutely unbiased. You have to be the unbiased observer. And I was fine with that idea when I was a very young journalist, just starting out of journalism school. But then seeing what I saw in Lesbos, I very quickly realized that I couldn't just be an unbiased observer. I was immediately biased, because there's just some issues in which you cannot see and keep, you know, a step back or a bit, like at least a big step back from them. It's an issue that I haven't really resolved myself. On migration, I clearly have my opinions and I tend to speak them out. And I've seen other journalists do it in a ways that I find very, very good in terms of sticking to the facts for sure, not hiding some information, for example. But still, it's very easy also, because there are such clear human rights violations happening by the European governments that you can say that in a totally unbiased way as a journalist. Reporting on climate issues for Climate Tracker, actually, I found it that I've encountered a similar challenge. Talking to civil society versus the government, for example. And I find it really hard to know which. I feel like I would need to still take a side, because for me personally, one is much more in the right than the other. But I find it quite hard to still keep some kind of objectivity in my articles.
I'd really like to dive into that, because I think it's one of the most interesting discussions happening for individual journalists, for news publications, for, you know, news industries around the world, this kind of required or this kind of faithful adherence to, or this absolute objection to, this idea of balance. And obviously everyone interprets it very, very differently. Just now you said about wanting to kind of say that one group is right and one group is not right. And I think that kind of other people might say, for example, you should try to present it in a way that the audience gets to decide who is right and who is not right. What do you think the difference is between those two approaches?
I think the second approach is a good idea. It still doesn't resolve the question of how much, for example, in simple terms, how many quotes you put of one side versus the other in your article. I've written stories before where I was told where there was a scientific consensus on an issue and people criticizing scientific consensus. And I was told very clearly by the scientists that if I put them at equal quantities in the article, people would probably choose the other side. Mm. When you report, some discourses are made to tailor to the audience, to convince them. And usually those are not the discourses that are going to scare them about our future, or discourses that are let's say that, for example, the political world knows better maybe how to frame certain discourses than a small NGO.
Sure. I mean, an easy lies is so much easier to spread than a complicated truth, right?
Yeah, it's easier if you put a conspiracy theory against a very complicated scientific explanation on why this issue of climate change is complex and has different facets. It's very probable that the conspiracy theory is what people are going to remember because it's tailored for that.
Sure. But there is also obviously a role to kind of question the sentiment, the feelings, the policy recommendations from what you might call civil society or from scientists. How do you think you can go about questioning those perspectives without uplifting the kind of denialistic perspective? Because obviously even that is a very difficult dance to do as a person who's creating a story.
It's also probably a question that I haven't fully answered for myself yet. Mm. I think diversifying your sources is probably a good way to put each other in question, each of the sources in question, by having different sources, like a triangle of sources that can all bring other aspects to what the other one is saying.
Yeah, so really try to kind of curate your story through the kind of stories of other people, as opposed to kind of necessarily worrying about writing it in your own words. But obviously there, you have that power of curating what the story is by picking and choosing which quotes you use and which quotes you don't and how you structure it and how you place it. So there is also another perspective saying that all of this idea of neutrality and balance is kind of a false reality, particularly when it comes to presenting scientific-based stories, that the kind of the Venn diagram, if you like, of being true and being neutral is such a small kind of circle in the middle of it, and kind of all the variations around it are so much bigger. Do you think that in obviously your brief experience so far that you might be drifting towards that perspective, or maybe fully believe in the perspective that there is no kind of neutral storyteller when it comes to things like the migration issues that you've seen or climate change?
I quite agree with that. I think that in any kind of reporting, the journalist is always an individual, and we always bring in our own experiences, our own biases, our own knowledge, or often limited knowledge to stories. Because what I've seen a lot is journalists going for only a few days, for example, to Greece for 3 days and having to report a big story. And of course, then lack of knowledge also plays a big role. But I would also go further and say that trying to be objective on this these issues can also be, to be fully objective, I mean, and fully balanced in your reporting, can also be the wrong way of reporting some of these issues.
Why is it the wrong way?
Because I think that when things are that dire, for example, for human beings, or when scientifically the situation is that serious, for example, talking about climate change, there is a duty for journalists to also convey this sense of urgency. And I think a lot of maybe more mainstream media, national televisions are trying to still, are afraid of showing emotion and showing personal involvement if they show too much emergency and too much, too much that is such a serious issue. And as a result, I think they tend to make quite cold reports which don't honor the stories and that don't convey the sense of urgency that the audience would need to get to be able to act on these issues.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think that might be one of the reasons why, you know, we have all become so fond of kind of social media storytellers over the last, you know, 12 years. I mean, Facebook only really became an international medium in 2009. It's been kind of a pretty dramatic shift of democratizing storytelling around the world. But, you know, when you watch the nightly news or when you read a newspaper and someone goes, also in the news, Myanmar military forces are suppressing activists and, you know, 60 people have been killed. It's very, very weird to kind of hear it in this kind of purely neutral tone when it's really a life and death story. And if you happen to have a friend from Myanmar, or if you happen to have people passionate about those issues, they tell them in such different ways. And obviously it's in no sense a neutral story that they're telling, but it's so much more a human and an emotive story. And I feel like that has been a transformation of storytelling that we've just all naturally, you know, become so in love with, because it just feels great to have someone truly express what this means to them in their own lives or in their own perspectives, whether it is kind of filled with anger or hate or sadness, or whether it is filled with love, versus that kind of, you know, that traditional idea of the absolutely neutral storyteller. And it sounds like, Julie, that you're kind of, I'm not saying that you're on the side of the kind of social media, everyone should tell their story exactly how they want to tell it, and there's no place for neutrality anymore. But I kind of, listening to you describe what you've been through, the stories you've tried to tell, it kind of makes me realize and makes me think about that kind of power of just saying how this makes you feel as another human being.
Yes, I think that hearing another human tell their story in a human way just touches people more straight to the heart. And I think on these issues, that is also what we want to do. We don't want to report on them coldly. We want people to understand. I think the role of the journalist is to also go to places where people can't go, hear about stories that people can't hear in their everyday life, and to report them how we've heard them. So if I'm a journalist and I'm going to the Central Mediterranean and seeing the migration tragedies that are happening there, I want to be reporting. I want people to feel the same way that I felt reporting on this. Of course, considering all the factual information too. But I think, yeah, telling it in the way that you're witnessing it and making people live the same experience is the best way to convey this information. Because ideally, people would see all these things with their own eyes. It would be the best way of informing people.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I wonder how the kind of the question of neutrality is framed when you don't think of it just as each individual story needs to be neutral, but you think of it as we are now in a media ecosystem whereby an individual person has the ability to read or see or engage with a story in 50 different ways through social media, through multiple television channels, through radio, through newspapers all over the place. And as a result, I wonder if now there is less of a need for an individual story to be neutral, because the audience, the reader, can find that objectivity by themselves, if you like. That kind of balance comes not through them reading one story, but comes through them reading 15 stories, which they're kind of very able to do. But obviously we know the way that people kind of engage with social media and with media these days is they often, you know, just keep reading the same story from the same perspective. So that kind of hope for neutrality is maybe lost. But it's really interesting talking to you about this. And you know, I can feel your passion for these stories. Do you think you're going to try to tell more stories about climate change and migration in the future?
Well, the next article I'm preparing for Climate Tracker hopefully will be about this topic. And I think it's, from what I've read, it seems really difficult to talk about climate migration because it's so much more complicated than that. It's not, I mean, some people, yes, have to flee because of natural disasters. But the kind of migration that we're imagining of people fleeing a drought, might happen, but it might also be much more complicated than this. And there will be probably very different flows of migration that have always also been there, but they might just be amplified by migration. However, I think that, yes, I will probably encounter this issue more and more as I keep working on this topic of migration, especially.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunately going to be a red hot topic for the next couple of years, particularly in the southern borders of Europe. I don't think there's going to be a solution anytime soon. And I unfortunately think that there's going to be more and more things to report there. So Julie, I'm very proud that we get to kind of somehow have a connection with you, and I'm very proud that you're going to be potentially one of those reporters telling that story for the next couple of years. And I really kind of look forward to seeing how you individually battle with that challenge of neutrality versus kind of wanting to tell a story from a very particular human perspective. Do you feel like you're going to be telling these stories for a while?
I hope so. I have been questioning the best ways of dealing with these stories in a journalistic perspective. And I think right now I'm maybe trying to direct myself more towards documentary filmmaking or short documentaries, kind of longer formats, in which I feel like there's more freedom and more space to just tell the complexity of stories. And I think also this applies to climate change issues and will be more and more necessary in the future. And I also think that in the time we're living in, where social media is so prevalent and people actually watch a lot of videos, even videos that are 10 minutes long, if necessary, on Instagram, I think this will be quite a good format to discuss these issues. So this is what I'm kind of looking in at the moment.
Well, I'm very excited to see what you're able to develop in the short and the long term. And Julie, thank you so much for taking the time out and for giving us part of your morning to kind of share your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for the show. I'm Chris Wright, as usual, and this is Climate Tracker Weekly. For comments, suggestions, and feedback, you can email us at podcast@climatetracker.org. Join us again next time for yet another episode of Climate Tracker Weekly, where we find another journalist, another location, and have another hopefully interesting conversation. See you then.